stupid kids that kill themselves. And so I didn't get much done. Well, I mean, because like I'm missing like two pages of it, and I kind of cut it wrong. Photocopier went crazy and put it on full size, so this is my team.
Okay, well, my scene's called Speak of the Devil, and it's about three kids that live on the same street. It's about me, Melody, and Duncan, and how we lived all our life on the same street and all like the different things we've done and weird stories about school and on the street and Walgreens and like different things and pictures and scrapbook stuff. So, yeah, gonna be done soon.
If you are interested in reading other zines or making your own, you should seriously consider checking out the Independent Publishing Resource Center. It's located downtown Portland on 917 Southwest Oak. Call 503-827-0249 for more information. And if you want to be our featured youth talent, go ahead and email Miss Yankee, advocate@kwyouth.org, I think. I'm pretty sure it'll get announced again later on in the show.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 Community Radio. If you want to call us up at 503-231-8187. Yay! And now, sing it. All right, here's a piece by me. It's The Sound of Mental Health.
In this first recording, a little boy who might be 4 or 6 has just discovered that the neighbor's dog has given birth to a little boy who might be 4 or 6 has just discovered that the neighbor's dog has given birth to a little boy.
It seems that mental imbalances are exceedingly prevalent these days. The hype surrounding illnesses often leads to unwarranted anxiety. People are very quick to self-diagnose a problem.
Oh no, I am obsessive compulsive. I am schizophrenic.
I am hyperactive.
It may be that one of the most widespread mental problems is hypochondria, thinking that you have a certain affliction despite no real problem or imagining the symptoms.
Scare a person by confusing his mind. Let's start one step at a time.
Thank you. thank me.
Okay, I won't.
You just heard a piece by Joe Thompson, and next is a very exuberant piece on grief by Erica Embry. Grief. The dictionary defines it as extreme emotional suffering caused by loss, misfortune, or disaster. And it seems like a simple concept to understand, but you cannot truly understand what it means until you have experienced it.
If I talk to someone and they make me laugh, I'll stop. And I think I'm not grieving right. I'm afraid that I'm not acting how I should. And I've been told that I shouldn't be so sad about it, because after all, he was only an animal, he wasn't a human. And I keep thinking about all the events that happened, and how if one thing had changed, how everything could have been avoided. It's funny how the death of a pet can affect your life.
Mourn. The dictionary says it is to grieve for someone who has died, but all people grieve differently. So what happened to you after your friend died?
I got really depressed for few weeks after that, and I drank constantly, went on a hardcore drinking binge. Couldn't really trust a lot of people either for a while. Still kind of can't.
How close were you to this person?
We were pretty tight. He was like my compadre. We used to hang out all the time on a daily. I'd put his hair up for him. He had this really tall mohawk. He was cool.
How old was he?
He was 15.
Have you ever had someone close to you die?
My great-grandmother, Margaret.
How did it affect you, or did it affect you at all?
I really wasn't fazed by it. I was kind of young, and she was pretty old. She wasn't that great a person anyway. She was kind of a mean great-grandmother.
Do you feel that it had any effect on you at all?
Well, I know how not to live now.
So how old were you when she died?
I'd say 6 or 7.
In the end, there is no rule to force your feelings, or even a right way to grieve. For the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Erica Embry signing off.
Can't you tell that it's well understood? I'm never gonna know you now, but I'm gonna love you anyhow.
Man, Beatmaster is getting crazy. Yeah, here's the announcements right now.
AM to 8 p.m., Thursday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, noon to 5 p.m. The Gresham, Hillsdale, Hollywood, and Midland libraries will be open Monday and Tuesday, 10 a.m. to 8 a.m., Wednesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Sunday, noon through 5. The Albina, Belmont, Capitol Hill, Fairview, Columbia, Gregory Heights, Holgate, North Portland, Northwest, Rockwood, Selwood, Moreland, St. John's, and Woodstock libraries will be open Monday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Tuesday and Wednesday, noon to 8 p.m., Thursday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, noon to 5 p.m.
Wow. On Saturday, September 18th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., Scrap is having a back-to-school party with free activities and workshops. For more information on call Scrap at 503-294-0769 or visit them on the web at www.scrapaction.org. And this Friday, the Velocipedes, a band consisting of KBOO youth members, is playing an all-ages concert beginning at 6:30 p.m. Yeah, other bands are playing too. The show will take place at the catwalk above the Meow Meow at 320 Southeast 3rd in Portland. Tickets are $7 at the door, $6 purchased from a band member. To buy a $6 ticket, email the band before Friday at the Velocipedes, VELOCIPEDES at yahoo.com, or call Brianna at 360-281-8477.
And if you would like to find out more about mental health and all their organizations of some sort, go to www.mindfreedom.org. And Joe?
And if you want to get... Oh, feedback. If you want to get involved with the Youth Collective, email advocate@kabu.org. And that's Erin Yankee. Her number is 503-231-8032, extension 511.
You should, like, call her for, like, getting your music played if you're in a band and stuff, because the Randomonium is on Friday at 11.
Okay.
Oh, any thank yous?
Yeah.
Any thank yous for the show?
Thanks, everybody.
I'd like to thank the Hamburger Helper Hand.
Thanks, Erin.
Yes.
Woo!
Yay.
Hi, this is Tyler Loftus with Travis Carney, and I'm with Nicole here, who works at, she works at a local hospital, yeah, sorry. Wow, I completely spaced that out. Okay, she works at a local hospital with the teen mental health unit, and we're down here to interview her on what it's like working down there. So, for starters, how is work day-to-day for you? Oh, we're having some technical difficulties here. Bear with us for a second.
Duke?
Oh, okay. We're together now?
All right. Is it working now?
All right, we are good to go. Mind
you. It's never dull, even here.
Yeah. Mind you, this is a youth radio station, so we're
learning.
Yeah.
All right, so anyways, I'm Tyler here, and I'm with Nicole, who works at a local mental health hospital. And I'm with Travis.
Hey, is my mic working too?
Yeah, everybody's back on course. So,
all right, awesome.
So, anyways, before we had that horrible, horrible technical difficulty.
Yes.
What do you do on a day-to-day basis for your job?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, I have a classroom in the adolescent unit at a hospital. It's a regular hospital, but then we have our own separate unit for patients that are having mental health issues. Could be anything from depression to an eating disorder to a psychotic break to out-of-control behavior, a whole gamut of things. Wow. And as the teacher there, I meet with each student in a classroom setting, and we do everything from writing assignments to art to positive self-esteem building activities, a little bit of everything. So every day is really different because we get new patients usually in the evenings when admissions are usually. So also I have to assess each patient. I have to give them a couple of little tests, which they usually don't like to do right away, but it just assesses their reading and writing and math skills just to see if they're on track that way. A lot of times a kid will come to us referred by a school where they've been doing really good in school, and then all of a sudden they'll go from A's to D's or F's. So something's not going on with them. So I try to determine maybe what one of the causes is. And then I also, during the school year, I liaison with their schools. So I'll talk to their counselors, talk to their teachers, find out how the student was before they had this mental health problem.
Right. So do you try to keep it like as basic as possible to keep that same school setting, or is it a little different than your normal school?
It's definitely different than a normal school. I mean, you can imagine I have kids from oh, 12, 13, all the way up to 17, 18 in the same classroom.
Oh, wow.
And so you have a great variance of skills. I mean, from some kids who, and we get kids that have been like homeless or kids that haven't been in school for a year or two, mm-hmm. to kids who are really concerned because they didn't get 800 on their SATs. So we've got quite a range. So I've kind of put together my own curriculum, and I have a lot of activities and a lot of teacher-made assignments that sometimes the kids work individually, and then sometimes they work as a group.
Right. So as you're kind of like the first line with the students, do you have like kind of a just a very professional relationship with them?
Well, I try to be professional as far as a teacher goes, but I think my role there, since I'm non-medical, mm-hmm. and the kids every day have to see a psychiatrist, you know, doctor, and then they have to see their social workers, and they have to see mental health therapists, and they have to deal with some pretty heavy issues. So I'm kind of like the balance. I kind of see myself as, oh, kind of the motherly or the big sister role,
right.
And I don't really need to delve into the reasons they're there as much as, okay, we're here right now, let's make the best of it, and
right.
and let's have a good time, too. I mean, there's a lot of laughter in the classroom, and
right.
All in all, I think the kids have a pretty good experience.
That's really comforting to know, because, like, I've been at a few points when I thought I was kind of a mental breakdown, and it's really good for me to know that there's kind of that good of an environment out there, and it's not really, you know, how they show it in the movies. It's not how...
Absolutely not.
All right,
absolutely
thank God.
Not. And the kids, when they come in, I mean, I always check in with them, like, so... Is this as bad as you thought it was going to be? Because most of the kids come to us with the ER.
Mm-hmm.
They've had some kind of a crisis, whether it's a self-inflicted injury or whether they've just blown out and tried to hurt somebody else or put a hole in a wall or,
mm-hmm.
you know, just you name it, they've done it. And a lot of them come in and they, like you said, their idea of a mental hospital is one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, my God. And so many of the kids say, I was just so afraid of the other kids, what kind of kids mm-hmm. I'm going to see there. And then they see the kids are just regular kids like you or me. I mean, everybody, it's heartening to see. I mean, they're friendly to each other and they really kind of help each other out in a way. I mean, they can't become really close friends or, you know, make any connections because that's, you know, counterproductive and it's just not a really healthy thing to do. But I'm very impressed on how they are kind to each other. And we get some kids that are very, very impaired, and the kids that aren't so impaired are usually very kind and understanding.
Mm-hmm. So on like a day-to-day basis,
mm-hmm.
on the average, what gender do you see more of? You see more youth females or males?
That's a good question. Right now, I'd say my first hit is, yes, we see more girls.
Mm.
It's, you know, maybe 40, 60.
Yeah, you hear that, guys? So be nice to your girlfriends. That's right.
Girls tend to come in with, and this is a generalization, but a lot of depression, some eating disorders,
mm-hmm.
Suicide attempts, whether it's cutting on themselves, taking pills, just general angst that,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of teenagers go through anyways.
Right.
Girls tend to turn their depression inward, whereas boys often turn it outward. They're the ones that'll put their fist through a window, or they'll jump out of a car, or they'll do something a little bit more, or, you know, just things that are a little bit more, get your attention really quickly.
Yeah. So, altogether, I think what we've learned here is everybody should just be a lot nicer to each other.
Yeah, that would be good.
It's a hard world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if you can answer this kind of a question, but how do people assess what is, like, a non-serious suicide attempt or a serious suicide attempt?
Yeah, that's a good question, because you always hear, oh, they were just doing it for attention.
Right.
Well, if you think about that, doing something like that for attention in itself is kind of a red flag.
Right.
I mean, we all like attention, but most of us don't attempt to hurt ourselves or take a lot of pills or things like that. So I think we're kind of all on the general side that if anyone does anything, it should be taken seriously. Even in the schools, like oftentimes a counselor will hear a student say, oh gosh, my life sucks. I'd be better off dead, or my parents don't care. I just might just kill myself. And I'm sure you've heard that from your friends. And,
oh, right.
I mean, you just hear that sort of thing. But I think each one of those statements should be acknowledged. And it is sort of a little bit of a red flag that says, you know, something's not right. We do get kids sometimes that stay with us maybe just overnight, and mm-hmm. we call that a soft admission, where somebody, you know, it probably could have been handled outside of the hospital.
Right.
But to make sure, and sometimes that's all the kid needs to realize, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that, and look what happened to me.
Right.
Or we'll get some kid in who, you know, broke up with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, and they say, oh, I'm going to kill myself. And then they come in and they see kids that have some really, really serious problems. Right. And that in itself sometimes is all it takes to make a kid realize that they don't have it so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Travis, do you have any questions for us?
No, not at this time.
You look like a healthy young man.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had some experiences out there. Do you have any heart-wrenching questions?
Question. How long have you been doing this?
That's a good question.
There you go.
I've been with the hospital about, 12 years. But prior to that, I worked for Boys and Girls Aid with court-referred kids, kids that were kind of out of control with the law. And prior to that, I was a special ed teacher at your old alma mater, actually, Beaverton.
Yeah.
So let's go back in time for a minute here. First day on the job at the hospital, was it like freaking out, kind of like, oh my God, these kids are crazy? Or was it just a normal teaching job?
Oh, it definitely wasn't a normal teaching job, because picture every day you don't know who your students are going to be.
I mean,
you have a few from the day before, but you always have a new one. So first day on the job, I was a little nervous because, one, it's a locked unit, and I mm-hmm. felt a little weird about that, tell you the truth, going into a locked situation. And just like everybody else, I wasn't sure what the population was going to be like.
Right.
But to be honest with you, as soon as I met the kids, I mean, they were just like any other kids I've had in public school.
Yeah.
And that's what I tell most of my friends, too. I go, you know, because they say, how can you do this day in, day out? And the kids are just everyday kids. You know, you get a few kids that are very chronically ill, but for the most part, these kids are going through a rough time, and it's going to pass, and they're going to get help, and I'd say the majority of them are going to get well and going to be out there.
That's good to hear. So all around, I'd say you enjoy your job?
Yes, very much.
So most people would get the idea that having to deal with this day-to-day would be a really depressing thing, but you, by all means, enjoy the interaction mm-hmm. with these kids.
I do. Every once in a while, some patient will kind of tug at your heartstrings, or you'll just see somebody that's living in a really bad situation, and it, you know, little things like that, and that makes you sad. But all in all, I think we're, all of us, I work with a really good team of people, and we definitely have the team approach where everybody has input, and I think that's really good for the patient, because we mm-hmm. come at it from such a different point of view, you know, from the social work, who's working with the whole family system and including the schools, and then the doctors, who, of course, are much more clinical and deal with meds and deal with different strategies. And then the mental health line staff, who work with the day-to-day, you know, getting the kids to take a shower and show up mm-hmm. for meals on time and that sort of thing. And then my portion of it.
Right. So from what I understand from talking with you earlier, you're kind of like the first line to see if the medication's working, right?
Well, I'm not the first line, but since I have the kids for 2 hours, and my classroom is really small. I mean, I can have as little as 7, 8 kids up to about 10 or 11. And so I get to see close up the effect that some of the meds are having on the kids. So mm-hmm. At the staffings, I'll say, you know, Johnny seems really sleepy today. I'm wondering if maybe their meds are, you know, haven't kicked in right, or maybe they have too much or too little. And like I said, we all kind of have input, and that way they're able to tell, oh, yeah, maybe he does have too much medication, or maybe this one isn't working right.
Right.
So in general, do you think people are born destined to be depressed, or are they driven that way, like their family surroundings?
Whoa, what came first, the chicken or the egg, huh? Well, they're learning more and more about depression. And, yes, there is a predisposition in some people, and it really is, in a lot of depression, it's a biochemical event of your brain. Your brain just not processing like serotonin the proper way, and so those people that get depressed that way, they respond really well to medication, because it just kind of tweaks the brain to handle all the chemicals the right way. And then, of course, there's people who get depressed or really sad because of a life-altering event. I mean, the death of someone, or a move, or being fired. You know, things like that. But there's a difference between being really sad and being depressed.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So I think it's a combination of things. Totally.
Right. And so would you say that home environment would be one of the, like, one of the key things that would be part of a depression or even just a sadness in general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, home environment, school environment, the kids you hang with, smoking, doing drugs. I mean, they've done so many studies, and there's so many variables, but they even did a study where kids who smoke cigarettes have more of a tendency to be depressed.
Oh, wow.
Than, yeah, I was surprised at that one myself. And then, you know, smoking a lot of pot or doing alcohol, all of those activities sort of depress your central nervous system.
Right. So in your opinion, this is an opinion question, everyone, so don't call in and yell at us for getting an opinion, please. But would you say that most of the students you work with, would you say that it's mostly like a chemical depression, or would you say it might be like a surroundings depression?
Oh, gosh. I can't really answer that question with any authority, but just for my general, I'd say most of them are depressed because of lifestyle they're leading and some chemical. It's really a little bit of everything. You know, I really couldn't give you a black and white answer on that one.
Yeah. So
it's much more complex than that kind of an answer.
Right. So the doctors out there who think that a pill is going to solve everything are wrong.
Right. Yeah. I don't think there's too many doctors who think that.
Right.
I think it works best with, you know, looking at medication, looking at therapy, looking at the family unit, looking at all of those things. Self-esteem. I mean, you know, at teenage years, all of us suffer from self-esteem issues sometimes in our lives. But I think as a teenager, when everything's changing, you really wrestle with that one.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's just about all the time we've got. So we're going to move on to our next piece here, and I'm not too sure what it is, but I'm sure we're going to enjoy it. So, Nicole, it's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And Travis, thank you for sitting in on us and giving us your good questions, and thank you for being a part of this. So you're listening to KBOO, and our subject today is mental health.
Hey, you're listening to the Youth Collective on 90.7 KBOO Community Radio.
And if you want to call us about the show or, you know, just anything, I guess, you can reach us at
503-231-8187.
231-8187. All right, so next up is a piece not directly related to mental health, but is about one amazing substitute teacher that working in the insanity of the public school system. Here's Joanna with some of the story of Baron.
What do I love about Baron? When he invited us to his house to go to the meteor shower party, it clouded over, but meteors were present anyway. He threw glow sticks in groups of three out of a window and then sent rock-like objects with fireworks coming out the back down on a string, and the last one was a flamingo. Thus, we had the best meteor shower in Portland that night.
That's my friend Laura, who had Baron as a substitute teacher in high school. Many stories about Baron are like this. They start out with strange happenings, and then they only get weirder. They're like the punchline of a joke whose beginning you never really know. Here are some things we do know about Baron. He's a tall, thin man with a full head of gray hair who rides his bike everywhere. He's the creator of the Universal Church of Fun, the owner of a black obsidian mirror of higher truth, and the proud curator of the Mystery Hole of Woodstock, a large hole containing mysterious hieroglyphics, a door that has never been opened, and a small chamber where people have been known to have visions.
Some people have visions.
It's all strange light.
Yeah.
One excerpt from Barron's website about the mystery hole reads like this. No one can say with authority that breathing the peculiar cool air which wafts up from the mystery hole can cure any and every illness you might have, nor that you will suddenly have more money than you know what to do with, nor that you will find true love in less than a month. However, there are those who feel that they have been helped in health, romance, and or money by breathing the enchanting vapors of encouragement, a trademark product. Just like Barron, everything about this statement is fun, playful, and both mysterious and completely obvious. Barron is also a substitute teacher, a mysterious profession, and I first got to know him in that role at Grant High School, where he teaches most days of the week. He teaches every subject, and strangest and most mysterious of all, students and teachers alike love him. I have a great deal of sympathy for substitute teachers. I always felt sorry for them because they seem to have a pretty thankless job. Few students like their substitutes, let alone remember them from visit to visit. It also seems like substitutes get all of the bureaucratic, boring tasks that teachers have without any of the benefits of teaching.
Substitute teaching has seemed like such kind of a rum deal to me, the way that you don't get to really get to know any of your students. You usually have them for a day or two. You don't get to make up your own lesson plans. You have to follow someone else's or hand out a worksheet. And don't get to interact with the students, but you seem like you generally love to do this.
I think substitute teaching is the best job in public school because it's the part that a lot of people go into teaching for. I don't have to give grades, and I rarely have a parent-teacher conference or any of the things that regular teachers have to do, teachers' meetings and so on. There's just at least half of the job is not directly related to the students, whereas I get to interact directly with students every day, and at the end of the day, I don't take home an armload of papers like some teachers do. So I don't get burned out on it. I really do enjoy the work, and that's probably why I have focused so much on being a substitute. I'm a career substitute. It's not something that, since I couldn't get a real job, I'm making do with.
He completely disagreed with me, but that's the point. I think most substitute teachers don't really interact with their students, but by being around Grant High School all the time, and by being himself, Barron does, both mysterious and completely obvious. Barron's like a breath of fresh air in the confining, often stagnant world of public school. And although he doesn't get to write lesson plans, I do think that Barron manages to teach his students something in each class.
I don't think that the captive audience should be somebody's project. It's not my position to come in and try to mold people in a way that I think society should be, without giving them just options, without presenting it as one more of the in the whole scheme of things for them to choose from and analyze.
I certainly agree. So I feel like you present kind of like a different way of being to some students that don't get exposed to all that many different choices, even though you say that you don't want to be presented. You want to present something as just another option or choice. But I felt like you presented yourself as another choice. I mean, in kind of like as a way of being, as a personality, and then as an educator too.
No, I think you're right. I am a one more possibility, and that's obvious. Each teacher that a student has and interacts with is one more, or every adult, we're all teachers in a way, is another example of how to be, or not to be in some cases.
Barron's self-deprecating entertaining that way. He says that every adult is another possibility for kids, but there aren't many adults that kids will listen to, let alone consider as a role model. There aren't even very many teachers that students will give their full attention to. My friend Laura recalls one day in biology class that gives me a clue as to why Barron's mystery hole and all the rest connect to the fact that he's a great substitute teacher.
I wonder what Barron's specialty is. Do you know? See, because I had him for every class. We had him for Latin. We had him for English. I've had him for biology. Yeah, pretty much every class you could possibly have a substitute for, Barron has subbed for. Oh, study hall.
Do you remember him ever doing something like, oh, I know this subject?
Well, in biology, he was with us on a particularly interesting unit, I remember, about what life is and what's alive. And everybody was just so into class that day because he made us all think, and we realize that the definition of life is sort of ridiculous because a virus isn't alive, but you know, a mushroom is.
But why? How did he make you do that?
He used just a list of characteristics or of organisms and asked us if they were alive or not, and got wildly differing views from across the room after he got past plants and animals. But, yeah, he sparked a lot of debate that day, I remember. That was a good day in biology. And far more interesting than the real teacher would have taught.
How is that different than what you think whoever it was teaching the class would have done?
It just wouldn't have been as mysterious. Because we didn't know if Barron knew.
Are you serious? That's really what made it interesting? Because you were trying to figure out if he knew, too?
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, he's in biology class. I just had it for English the day before, and I didn't know if he knew biology class, you know, the subject matter for biology.
So you were, like, trying to figure out him as you were trying to figure out...
Of course. I think we all were. Barron's totally mysterious. Yeah. Yep.
So are you saying by being totally mysterious, he made you more interested in what you were learning?
Sure.
Because to find out what you were learning, you maybe could find out about him, too?
That's definitely true, because everything that he said something about him, but no one could quite trace it all the way back.
So here's how my reasoning goes. Barron is a mysterious person. It's also mysterious to me how he manages to appeal to many types of students. But at least according to Laura, part of the answer to the last mystery seems to be the fact that the first exists. A circular statement that Barron, who is fond of saying,
just about everywhere you go, there's something. Except for the mystery hole, dude, that's going to be nothing. Probably the main attraction.
Would enjoy. To analyze what's great about Barron, I come up with nothing rather than something, an absence of all the bad things that substitute teachers do or are forced to do, and the presence of something nebulous that no one can prove will not make your years at high school a whole lot better. He's nothing like what students expect from their substitutes, and that's really something. You can find out more about Barron, his mystery hole, zombie croquet, and being a substitute teacher at www.barronmind, that's Barron, BarronMind.com. This is Joanna Stein for the KBOO Youth Collective.
I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy?
Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be?
Hello, you're listening to the Underground 90.7 KBOO. We were yelling just now to relieve the pre-show stress that always is in the air room. Like, just trying to preserve our mental health, which is the theme for this month's show. Mental health. Let's see. Next, here's a piece by Amber Loringer about lobotomies.
The following is a brief history of the lobotomy. It all started in the 1890s when a German scientist, Friedrich Goltz, tried removing parts of dogs' brains to alter their behavior. Later, in the 1930s, another scientist, Carlisle Jacobson, tried removing parts of chimpanzees' brains to alter their behavior. Both times, it had some rate of success. So, a Portuguese neuropsychiatrist, Dr. Antonio Egas Moniz, decided to try a similar operation on human mental patients. Thus, the lobotomy was born. Moniz and his colleague Almeida Lima developed a procedure where they drilled holes in each side of a patient's head and stuck a little wire knife in, jiggling around to separate the front part of the brain from the rest. Several patients who had been previously agitated, anxious, or depressed improved. Some didn't. Moniz was careful to say that the operation should only be used in a hopeless case. Enter American doctor Walter Freeman, who met Moniz at a conference in 1935 and became fascinated with his work. Since Freeman had no surgical experience or qualifications, he teamed up with a neurosurgeon, Dr. James Watts, to try the technique on patients in America. Watts and Freeman performed their first few lobotomies in 1936, with Watts doing the cutting and Freeman navigating. For a while, lobotomy was not widely accepted, but then in the 1940s it became a question of economics. Mental asylums were becoming overpopulated, and it was simply more cost-effective to do a lobotomy, which would cost about $250, than to spend the $35,000 or more a year to maintain a patient in a hospital. Combining these factors with Freeman's sway over the press, this surgery became much more popular in the United States over the next few years, and American neurosurgeons rapidly developed lots of variation. In 1945, Walter Freeman developed his own improvement to the procedure, one which didn't require drilling any holes and was amazingly even less precise than the previous ones. This was known as the ice pick lobotomy, and it consisted of inserting an ice pick through the eye socket above the eye at an angle up into the brain, then jiggling it around and taking it back out. It only took a couple minutes and could be performed under general anesthesia. You didn't even have to knock the patient out. And it was so simple that even someone like Walter Freeman, who had no surgical experience, could do it. It was also apparently so ghastly to watch that seasoned neurosurgeons would frequently faint when observing it. Freeman's partner, James Watts, didn't approve and broke off from him then. Being now so quick and easy, the lobotomy soared in popularity, and between 1939 and 1951, 18,000 lobotomies were performed in America alone. They were considered a good cure for all kinds of mental disorders, and sometimes families would submit difficult relatives to lobotomies just to get rid of them. And plenty of political radicals were also considered as mentally ill, so they could be lobotomized and then no longer dangerous. For a long time, nobody bothered to study the long-term effects, and nobody considered the numbers. Only about a third of patients lobotomized actually showed improvement, which is about the number that would probably have gotten better on their own anyway, and an equal number got worse. By the early 1950s, though, opposition finally started to build up. Lobotomies had started being considered as a first rather than last resort cure for mental patients, and since the ice pick lobotomy was generally performed by psychiatrists with no knowledge of surgery, post-operative infections and just plain fatalities were quite common. Apart from the ethical questions, which were finally, though belatedly, raised, during the 50s, many drugs were developed that could help mental patients, and most psychiatrists gladly tossed away their ice picks and hailed pharmaceuticals as a new miracle cure. This has been Amber Loringer for the KBOO Youth Collective. Up next is Ben Hyde.
I interviewed Diane Hyde about a great place called Kinship House, which specializes in innovative mental health and child welfare services. And boy, did she have a lot to say.
What is Kinship House?
Kinship House is a nonprofit agency that's located in Northeast Portland, and it provides services for kids that are in permanent planning, that are kids that are headed towards adoption or permanent placement, and it also provides post-adoptive services for children and their families, for kids that have already been adopted.
And how long has this existed?
Kinship House first opened its doors in the fall of 1996, and it was started in response to changes in funding for kids that were in the foster care system. And with managed care, it looked like these children were not going to be able to receive integrated services, but were going to receive short-term episodic services for a very difficult situation where they needed both mental health services and they also needed child welfare services to help them find placement and to help them make that adjustment. The typical child or children that come to Kinship House for services are children that are in what's called permanency planning. They're with the Department of Human Services, or what we used to refer to as Services to Children and Families. These are kids that it's pretty clear that they're not going to be able to be returned to their biological families for a variety of reasons, and so are on a track for permanent planning. That means that they're either going to be an adoptive home will be found for them, or they will find a permanent placement, either with a relative or with a non-relative placement. Either way, they won't be returning home. These are kids that are not the infants that need adopting, but the children that are older, who have multiple problems perhaps and have had multiple placements. So these are children that come with a high need for services, both mental health services and child welfare services. So what Kinship House provides is integrated wraparound services that combines both the mental health and the child welfare services.
What does Kinship try to achieve?
Kinship House has a lot of different goals that are all aimed toward working with this population of children and families. And what they do is they provide both direct mental health services in terms of individual counseling with these children and their foster parents or their prospective adoptive parents, or after they're placed in a permanent home with their families, and post-adoptive services or post-placement services. So there's the mental health component, and then there's working very closely with the child's caseworker to help them find the right adoptive home and to help make that transition or adjustment. And then other services that are provided are support groups for foster parents, support groups for kids that are actually in the permanency planning track for a long period of time, because sometimes it takes a while to find a home for these children. And so we provided lots of different services for these children and their families, as well as hooking them up with appropriate medical, psychological care. If they need to see a physician for medication, then we have a medical director who is a behavioral pediatrician who we provide contact with. So we also provide other sorts of services, like training to the caseworkers for Department of Human Services. The caseworkers that work with these children, we go out and we do trainings at least once a year for these new caseworkers that are joining Department of Human Services to share with them exactly what these children need so that they can be better informed with how to help them. We also have served our mental health clinicians. Our staff have also served as expert witnesses in children's court to provide testimony for what children best need. And so we are recognized as expert witnesses in this field.
When did you get involved in Kinship House and why?
Well, I first became involved in Kinship House back in 1995 and was instrumental, along with a group of other mental health clinicians that had been working in community mental health with this population of children and families. And as I alluded to earlier, we realized that the funding was changing and that these services were no longer going to be able to be provided for these children in the way that they needed, as far as having a long-term relationship with one person rather than a rapid turnover of being in and out of treatment. We also found that there was a gap in services where children were receiving mental health services in community mental health in a vacuum that was not connected at all to their caseworker services. And so we felt that these services really needed to be integrated. So a group of clinicians, mental health clinicians and community mental health, got together and decided to do something about it. So we formed a 501c3 nonprofit and became a 501c3 recognized nonprofit in January of 1996, and then worked hard to come up with funding and opened our doors in Northeast Portland in October of 1996. And our funding comes from a variety of sources, both from county through county funding for the mental health component and some funding through the state for the training that we do with caseworkers and for the social services component that we provide. We also have individual grants and donations that we are constantly applying for, but with the severe funding cuts, we've also experienced a drastic reduction in funding, as have, I think, most small nonprofits.
So would you say that your funding isn't enough to do what you guys would like to do or improve it?
Funding is always a struggle, as with most nonprofits. We've managed to keep the doors open despite great odds as a small nonprofit, and we continue to apply for funding. But yes, it's definitely a serious problem, and we will continue to provide services.
Where do you want Kinship to go in the future, and where do you think it will be in the future?
Well, where I would hope it would go, I would hope in my heart of hearts that we could eliminate the need for Kinship House, that there wouldn't be a need to provide these sorts of services, these types of services, because it would be more money that would go into preventative planning and helping families much earlier on so that children could remain with their families and not have to be placed in permanent foster care or in adoptive families. However, I also realize that that's not very realistic. My hope is that Kinship House will be able to continue to serve this very special underserved population of children that are among a population of children that are often, because they are older and readily sought after for adoption, it makes it more difficult. They have typically a host of other issues that they may suffer from learning disabilities to some medical problems. So this is a very fragile population of children that we serve. And so it's my hope that we can continue to serve them and provide everything that they might need in terms of mental health and coordinating with their caseworkers.
That was Diane Hyde, a.k.a. my mom, one of the co-founders and one of the first co-directors of Kinship House, who then served on the board for many years. If you want more information or wish to make a donation, call 503-460-2796. Once again, 503-460-2796.
It's trying to give you what you ain't used to.
For the KBU Youth Collective, this is Ben Hyde.
Because this month's theme is mental health, I wanted to create a piece that reflected my own struggle with mental sanity. Here it is. People say insomnia is a problem, but I don't see what's so bad about it. It's fun to stay up late and see what the world looks like at 4 in the morning. Personally, I use my time I'm not asleep to do other things, like let my artistic creativity flow or finish my radio piece for the underground. The best part about hardly ever sleeping is that you get to experience so much. The average person only gets to see what takes place during the day, but us insomniacs, we get to see the first rays of sunlight and the last drop of night sky. While I was not sleeping one night, I decided to look up the amount of hours a person is supposed to sleep each night. I found that most scientists believe that teenagers need to sleep 9 to 10 hours a night. I'm lucky if I get that much sleep a week. On a normal night, I head to bed about 2 or 3 in the morning. I wander around in my room for a while, cleaning or searching for some record I've misplaced. Eventually, I fall into bed. I often come across some book about math and end up reading several chapters before shutting off the light and staring at the ceiling. It's harder to go to bed after you've spent a couple hours reading about the fascinating discoveries made by amazing people throughout history. I spend a few hours contemplating these great mathematicians before finally drifting off. I wake a few hours later to my cat biting my toes. I shake him off me and go back to bed. An hour later, my cat causes another distraction, and I rise again. This continues until mid-morning when I get out of bed and begin my day. Everybody says that my sleep deprivation is going to hurt me somehow, but so far, I've carried on just fine. I get good grades, I excel in mathematics and English, and I still find the energy to participate in work and volunteering. I guess I could take drugs or try herbal remedies to reduce my insomnia, but what's the point? Some of the most creative people have been insomniacs. Van Gogh suffered from insomnia, as well as Thomas Edison. It's believed that Edison's hate for sleep is what drove him to create the light bulb. Pascal, the famous mathematician, was an insomniac. So was Napoleon. So maybe insomnia really is a horrible condition that will someday be my end. Until then, though, I'll simply consider it a blessing. From the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Brianna, signing off.